You know, a lot of the materials that were used back 200-300 years ago were toxic. Can't safely use them. So over time, I kind of really developed ways to get color. I never used stain. When I started my company and when I shift to my path that I'm in now, the craft and the art of painting was important to me. We basically did everything by hand. I've always played at the high end of the market, and I like teaching people that don't play in the high end of the market. You have options. And I was telling them what I could do, and they looked at me like I was a Martian. And then I made a sample for them, and they were like, wow. They could see what I did, but they didn't grasp it at all.
The Blue Collar Voices Show.
The answer to last episode's trivia question is 44,385,667.25 pounds.
Hello, Blue Collar Voices listeners. Today, our guest is Robert Chicky. He is a wood finisher expert. His tagline is, I solve seemingly impossible wood finishing issues. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
Robert, explain in a brief nutshell what it is that you do.
I solve problems for designers and architects. I basically create the process, because all color and formulas are processes, to achieve a look or a concept or a style that a designer architect is trying to achieve. And then in turn, I share that information with their vendors who can't get there. So essentially, I create a formula and a path for others to achieve whatever look or concept their client is looking for.
Kind of like you just develop the process and you hand that off and you say, do this, this, and this, and this, and we'll get what we're after.
Exactly.
Okay. What led to you developing this specialty of yours? How did you come upon this particular track in your career?
My story is kind of interesting. I was a painter, turned into a painting contractor. I always played in the high end of the market. So I started my company, this previous company, in 1991. I had a few employees at that time in the 90s, at least in the upper Midwest where I was. I'm based out of Minnesota. Everything was white. The walls were white. The woodwork was white. I mean, to this day, I just hate painting white. I got so bored with it that I almost got out of the business. I was not challenged. It wasn't creative for me. And so I looked at wood finishes and I thought, okay, I'm going to go into wood finishes because it's different, you know, and it's something that's not really utilized or tapped into. But everywhere I looked, it was always the same. It was brown and shiny. It didn't really capture the wood. The whole point to me was you weren't adding value to a product. Even when somebody takes such effort and craft to build something extraordinary, like an extraordinary piece of furniture, the common process that was available then in the marketplace really didn't add value. All it did was cover and protect it. That made no sense to me. I would look at antiques, furniture, woodwork from, you know, 100, 200, 300 years old, and you would look at it and you could see a richness and depth and clarity, even though it's a color. How did they do that? So I read and I researched and I found a path for coloring wood without stain. And over time, I developed a way to get that. You know, a lot of the materials that were used back 200-300 years ago were toxic. Can't safely use them. So over time, I kind of really developed ways to get color. I never used stain ever to color wood because essentially stain hides wood. It's all pigments. And over time, I taught myself how paint is made, how stain is made. And I learned little nuances of how to manipulate coatings. And so over time, again, I created what is known as reactive color. And a reactive color is an organic way of changing the color of wood. And essentially, it's this. All wood has a basic building block in it called tannin. It's like the pigment in your skin. Some wood has a lot of it, some woods don't. And so when you use other organic materials that you mix in water, hence the safety of this stuff, and you put it on the wood, it reacts with the tannin in the wood, and it automatically shifts the color. And the color is actually part of the wood. It is now in the wood because it occurs at the cell level of the wood. So you can take a white piece of wood and put a chemical on it in water and just watch it turn brown or red or black or blue or whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. And then you build color outward using other organic mediums. So you can have just this extraordinary depth that when people see it, they're just absolutely blown away by it because it's not something they're used to seeing. You know, one of the biggest issues I have is getting it exposed. People see it and they're like, oh my God, what did you do here? It's just a different approach. Today, everything is available at the paint store. That's it.
I would have never thought that there was anything besides a stain or a paint. What you're talking about is a totally new concept to me.
It is for a lot of people. 20 plus years, I've been playing with reactive color and I've honed my knowledge. There's not a color I can't make, period.
It sounds like you could take, with what you're talking about, just a cheap piece of pine and make it look really stellar.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the knowledge that's out there is been taught by coatings companies who tell you, you have to use X to get your finish, to get your look. If you go back and look at the industry standards, like in the commercial world, there's the AWI, the American Woodwork Institute, I think is what it's called, sets a standard of how you should color wood, the process. That information was provided by coatings companies. They tell you, you have to use our products, and this is the path for which you can achieve whatever you're trying to do. So even no matter what your skill set is, if you're a very basic beginner using stain, or if you're a seasoned elite creative professional using dyes and toners and shaders and all kinds of fantastic products that they produce, you will have a certain look. But there are thousands of other ways to do it that have a completely different outcome. And that outcome for me, the most important thing for me is to see the wood. I never understood the path of why using stain made any sense. You color the wood, period. So when you take a piece of softwood like pine and put stain on it, it turns it a color.
Right.
But it's muddy. It's muddy. You don't see the wood. That makes no sense. I look at it differently than other people. But when you show someone what is actually possible, that you can actually take a piece of wood, any wood, no matter what, even scrub pine, and give it a color and have total clarity. The concept is something that they can't even wrap their brain around. It's possible.
I'm very interested to see examples of this. And I know that you probably have pictures of a before and after.
I do. I have a lot of stuff on my Instagram page because that's where I do a lot of posting. one of the things that I've done recently is a concept that most people really struggle with trying to understand. Today, one of the trendy things is a black color. And it's possible to get black with stain or dye. Some people use India ink. There's all kinds of ways to get it. But the problem is when you have black, it's opaque. You lose the wood. You can see the texture of the wood still. If it's oak or walnut or even pine. Pine doesn't really have texture, but you can see the early wood and the late wood of the pine. They raise up a little bit when you put a coating on it. But with my approach, with reactive color, you actually can have black and it's translucent. That's an oxymoron to most people. How can you have a black color and see through it to the wood? That doesn't make sense on any plane.
Right.
But I've done it. There was a few companies on Instagram that said, I have X. There's a guy, the company in Ohio had some red oak tables, and they said their client wanted it black, and he told me the products he was going to use. And I said, yeah, it'll get you black, but you're not going to see anything. You might as well paint it. I understand that most people don't play in the world that I play in. And so it's, again, exposure to what is possible.
Right.
When you imagine today, in today's environment, most people don't make anymore. Most people go to the paint store or their coating store and say, match this for me. And the coating store is inundated by this enormous amount of people who are coming in and saying, make this. They don't have time to get you to perfection. They get you in the ballpark and then say, here it is. Even guys that are really, really skilled at the paint store, and there are a few of them, get you close. I don't deal in close. I deal in perfect. You want this color? That's the color I make for you. But my color, you see right through it. A lot of times when I was a painting contractor, we worked around the country, and I was in my heyday. I had 12 employees. You know, I was very well known for, in the small circle that I worked in, of being able to create whatever color you want. A lot of times I kind of cut my teeth on this reactive color and learning about historically accurate finishes, because a lot of the materials that I use were materials that were used back 200-300 years ago. The reason they fell out of favor is because they're not production-oriented. That's why a lot of fantastic materials that are not known today are not in the marketplace, because they don't dry fast. You can't put 15 coats on it a day. Everything today is geared toward, you know, it has to come out of a spray gun. It has to get done quick. And that's the production mentality, but you lose so much. When you imagine from, say, 1920 to 1990, the coating of choice in this world was nitrocellulose lacquer in the commercial space and sometimes in the residential space for a clear finish, a sprayable product, a product that you could fix, easily fix. When you put another layer on it, burns back in. So it's fixable. But then the coating company said to you, well, we got this better product. It's called pre-catalyzed lacquer. It's a little hardier because now we take the lacquer and we add a catalyst to it to make it a harder film. And you can sort of fix it, but it's harder, so it's better. Why is it better? People don't ask those questions. And then they came up with called a post-catalyzed lacquer. You can't fix it. It's super hard. It's bulletproof. You shouldn't have to fix it. Well, people are hard on things. To fix something, to me, that means you use the same product to fix it. Once this stuff cures, you cannot fix it. You have to use a different product to fix it. And so that has actually created a whole new industry for people that go around fixing these finishes. And how insane is that? Because they are production-based, period. But the art and the craft is lost. Because it's all about what the coatings companies produce.
All that being said, what makes your methods better?
I'm not necessarily say that it's better or worse. You know, when I was a contractor, I would get frustrated with, why don't people see why my side is better? And now, you know, having had the life path that I've had, I'll get into that in a minute. Now, I just want people to be aware that there is options. Every coating has components in it that make it viable for whatever application they're trying to do. The coating is three basic things, and then all the other things they put in it. So a coating is essentially a solvent, a binder, and a pigment. And in a clear, it's a solvent, a binder, and a dryer. Once you understand that, there's a lot of things you can do with coatings. Things that people tell you you can't. I'm like, no, you can't, but I can. And so when you have those kind of parameters, what people don't realize, all the other things that go into a coating, the chemistry that is put in there is all about production. I just happen to think it's, for me, doesn't add value. When you walk into a residence and they're spraying catalyzed lacquer and you have to be in a full body suit to work in that environment, how is that safe? And literally the stuff smells that bad that no one else can be in the house. I just want people to realize you have choices. Everything at the paint store is not everything that's out there. It's just what you've been exposed to. I use products that don't smell.
You can smell them.
Yes, you can smell them. But there are actually organic coatings, organic materials, materials that come out of this earth that are better than those products. But they don't dry in 5 minutes. They have fantastic visual optical qualities. They can be repaired. They're super durable. I mean, how durable does it have to be? I've been involved in projects where there's been catalyzed coatings. I did a project a few years ago. I'll give this a funny story. I was brought in to try and solve an issue for an architect. And there was 50 doors in this house. And they were bird's eye maple, special veneers that were brought in. And the painting contractor did something along the process, and it didn't matter why, the moisture got underneath the film and they were starting to turn the doors cloudy. I looked at them and I said, okay, the only way you can fix this is to release the moisture under the film. Now, if this was a pre-catalyzed lacquer, I'd have an option. But since it's post-catalyzed, the only way to get the moisture out is to get the film off.
Is it like an impermeable layer or quasi?
It's, yes.
Okay.
It's like an automotive finish in your house. Most strippers won't even strip it off. You actually have to cut through the film. You got to remember that the film is maybe 2 millimeters or 3 millimeters thick. So you got to cut through it without damaging the veneer underneath. So that's a serious skill set there. And then the stripper gets underneath to get it off. I mean, ultimately, the cost to get it off was almost more than to rebuild the doors. But they ended up buying 50 new doors. The doors were $1,000 a door. 50 grand. Because of the choice of the material that was made.
That's expensive.
I just said, I wish I'd have known about this project. I wish you'd have known about me before, because your outcome with this, I would have blown your mind what was actually possible. I'm not saying my way is better. It's just different. And it's about how you evaluate for you the look. Because that's what's important here. Choice. As I said, I used to say my way is better. You can't say that. People have to have a choice, but you have to inform them, educate them about this is what you know. Even at the highest end, if you're the most creative person using finite set of materials, you're going to have finite results. I understand the very basic to the highest end you can play with conventional coatings. I can go and do that. That makes my knowledge valuable. But then I also have this other side, the side that I created. People look at me like I'm from Mars when I tell them what's possible. I'm just here to show you that you can go here and get this. And I'm making it. Today, there's really nothing at a paint store I buy off the shelf. My brushes, sundry items, but there's fantastic products that do come out of a can from small companies around the world that understand that you can have extraordinary. They don't have huge budgets to promote their products than, you know, the big guys that are out there. People don't ask the right questions. I think they want easy. I want X. Okay, well, it must be available at my paint store, even though I don't even understand what's in it. And so when there's a problem, they're lost. And it's a huge problem in our industry today that many contractors are great applicators because there is definitely a skill set in learning how to put it on. But when you have a problem along the way and you do the same thing over and over and over and expect a different result, well, that's kind of insane. It is.
True.
If you just really understood that these coatings change constantly because they have to, because the regulations say you have to, but they don't tell people they're changing them. I always knew right away when a coating changed. I could see it, feel it. I got it. And I would call them up and say, hey, you changed this. And they'd be like, we didn't do that. I'm like, okay, fine. And I would just go elsewhere. I just got to the point where I would make my own. But I understand that's a way different level of knowledge.
Right.
But people need to understand that they have options. You don't have to use stain. But that's all you know. Let me just ask you this. On what other industry is the word stain a positive, have a positive connotation? Name one.
I would say that typically it's a stain is a problem.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, when I was a painting contractor, as I said, I had 12 employees and we did projects that were many, many months. We were really not production oriented. When I started my company and when I shift to my path that I'm in now, the craft and the art of painting was important to me. We basically did everything by hand. I mean, we had the capability of spraying, but I just wouldn't do it in somebody's house. And I would teach my staff, you can brush a coating and make it look sprayed. It's a skill set. I'm going to teach you how to do it. And that's what we did. I just kind of had a life event in 2010. I had a freak accident and broke my leg at my house. Just a weird thing. I went home to cut my grass because that's what I did. It was mindless to take my head out of gear.
Right.
And I got between my dog, which was a big 8-pound lab, and a rabbit. And in his full charge, he hit my leg and flipped me up in the air. And when I came down, I drove my kneecap into my tibia and split it like a log. Down, not across.
Ouch.
And I didn't go back to work for 11 months. Just life just took a hard right turn. You know, I tried to keep my company going, but it was just, I didn't walk in my office for 11 months. And when I did, I walked in on crutches. So just came apart. the next few years were challenging, to say the least. I was definitely lost. I couldn't really go work for another painting company because everything they did really went against what I was about. So I tried working for other organizations. It just amazed me as how many people really didn't care. Average was okay. People accept this. I was like, again, you know, when you play at the high level that I played at, it was just, it was heartbreaking for me. It was soul sucking, actually. In 2016, I just said I'd had enough. I have to find a path for me to play at the level I'm capable of. I thought, what makes sense here for me? When I was a contractor, why did people come to me? And they came to me because of what I was able to produce. But the cost involved was always a barrier because of the way we did it. So I knew that I was usually 2.5 to 3 times what was already on that job, which is a huge bite for somebody. So I said, if I created the path for someone to achieve my finish, my approach, without the labor and in an easier way, they could be successful. And so that's what I did. And so I don't have employees right now, but I mean, as I scale up, I'll eventually get them again, but it's just a different way now. Now I travel around the country. And in the last year, I've traveled so many places. It's not funny, but it's exciting to go and teach somebody a different way because it opens up their world. When you tell them you can make X in water, you know, they look at you like you're speaking Russian to them until you show them. And then you're just like, holy cow.
And touching on that, you're talking about the organic materials. What are like some of those organic materials? Help me understand. I mean, I can envision it could be like ground up rock or something.
Right. A common path that people talk about is a product called iron acetate. And it's just basically a really pretty much well-known one is you take white vinegar and steel wool or steel or something like that, and you stick it in the vinegar. There's a chemical reaction that happens. The acetic acid, the vinegar, pulls the iron particles off the steel, and it creates this liquid, iron acetate. And so when you put it on woods that have high tannin, like oak, it turns it black. I mean, instantly, it turns it black. You brush it on, and it's black in a millisecond, and it's clear. That's a pretty well-known one, but there's lots of things. There's different seeds. There's tree bark. There's salts, mineral salts from different parts of the world. And literally, you can take, when you finish wood a conventional way, most people say, okay, like I have a piece of alder. Alder reacts this way when I put stain on it. It guides your path. And I'm like, wrong. That wood is a blank canvas. I direct its path. You can pre-treat it with tannic acid. You could put more tannic acid in it. And tannic acid comes from a variety of sources. It comes from the tannin of a hide from an animal. It comes from oak gall trees. It comes from acorns. I mean, you get it. It's an organic product. They dry it out. It's in a powder form. You mix it in water at various ratios. Put it on the wood.
Does the tannin from a tree react differently than tannin from an animal hide?
Not really, because you can mix it in ratios. Once they synthesize it down, it's a basic building block.
Okay.
And then you put it on the wood in water. Again, I mean, there's no smell. It's a little bit of a smell, but it's nothing like conventional coatings. There is definitely a learning curve here, and it's a big one. There are rules you have to follow when you play with a reactive finish. You can't just slop it on, because the minute it hits the wood, it colors the wood. So you really have to understand that. And then it's possible to go backwards with a coding. People tell you that's impossible. It's like, well, again, it's not. By altering the pH of a coating, by altering the pH of a species of wood, you can make it do things. It's mind-blowing what's possible. I mean, you can actually take shellac. Most people, I don't know. You know what shellac is?
I really don't. I've used it, but I don't know what it is.
It's an organic product. It comes from a bug. It's an excretion of this lac beetle during the birthing process of its young. That's where it comes from. To make shellac, it's liquefied in denatured alcohol. It is actually possible to mix shellac with water. I can take water and change the pH of the water by putting an additive in that water. And that will allow me to take that shellac flake and liquefy it. No smell.
Everything that you're describing here almost makes me think of an alchemist, but it is absolutely a higher, much more in-depth process of treating wood. Because this is, like you mentioned, it's way past just going to the store and buying something of a particular color and applying it.
Right.
This is a multi-step process with everything that you're doing.
Yes, it is. It's not quick. I'm not going to say it is. Again, you know, I've always played at the high end of the market, and I like teaching people that don't play in the high end of the market. You have options. You don't have to use stain. You can use dye. Just dye. Dye is a translucent medium. You can go to, probably not a paint store, but you can go to a hardware store, you know, a specialty hardware store. You can get dye online. If you get one that has no binder in it, that makes it miscible in both water and alcohol. You can get whatever color you want and see right through it. Most people don't know that's possible because the information they get is everything, all your answers come out of a can at the paint store. That's the way it's taught. All the media, all the TV shows, they're all like, all your answers are stain or polyurethane, which I absolutely hate. I think it's the most heinous stuff on the world. But we won't go there. But again, what's at the store is a nick on what is actually possible.
Okay. How much of this that you're doing has been self-taught versus, like I see on your LinkedIn profile, you studied finishing from the 17th through the 20th centuries. How much of it was perhaps a rediscovery process to research and perhaps rediscover how they did things versus things that you've just created yourself?
And most of it's been a rediscovery. When I was first starting, you know, in the mid-90s, I was going back and researching treatises from the 16th to 17th century and looking at what did they use. And then I went into the 18th century and 19th century, which is more indicative of what I was playing with in Minnesota. I'll tell you, though, it's kind of interesting. Along the way, I started a project in 2001 where a client was, they were obviously a wealthy client, but they were going to go to a castle in France and buy some rooms, take them apart and bring them back and put them in their house. But the contractor talked them out of it and just said, you know, there's so much reconfiguring that this doesn't make any sense. And a friend of one of her friends said, go talk to Robert. He's different. So I was invited to come by and talk to this client. I'm the architect and the builder. And I was telling them what I could do. And they looked at me like I was a Martian. And then I made a sample for them, and they were like, wow. They could see what I did, but they didn't grasp it at all. And I was still relatively early in my career. I'd only been doing this for like 5 years at that point. compared to what I know now, I was an infant. The Klan had this really extensive antiques collection, and they said, I'm going to have my conservator talk to this guy before we sign him. So they flew in their antiques conservator, who's one of my friends today. And we had a nice conversation, and he was like, tell me what you do. And I told him what I do, and he was like, oh my God, man, that's what I do with antiques. I'm like, really? Yeah, well, that's what I put in people's houses. And so that was my approach. That's where I learned my knowledge, was going back and looking at how they would restore antiques, because that's my path. I want my wood to look like that.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, through him, I met a bunch of people that play in that field that are conservators. I met this one gentleman named Don Williams, who makes me look stupid, and I don't consider myself stupid. He, at the time I met him, was the senior conservator for the Smithsonian for furniture and wooden objects. Brilliant man. I learned a ton from him. And so I studied with him about transparent and polychrome coatings. And I learned a lot. And it just further enabled me to manipulate coatings to do what I wanted to do instead of what people tell you what's possible. It's like, you know, this wood will only do X. I know better. That's your experience. That's all you know. And I appreciate that. But I know different. I know I can take whatever wood it is and do what I want it to do. And it's viable. It's scientific. It's good science. It's just different knowledge. It's a different approach. And so now that's what I do. I teach people, and I want people to understand you have options.
So how do you combine this together with protection? Like if you're coloring the wood, but you also want the wood to be protected, how do those two go hand in hand?
So my path now, as I travel around the country, is I can make the color with reactive color because it's in water. It's a chemical reaction in the cell level. So you can put whatever you want on top, technically.
As long as it's not polyurethane.
And so because I, you can even use that if you so choose to, but because I have the knowledge I have as a painting contractor, I know virtually every conventional man-made coating system that exists on the market. So I can work in all those mediums. But as I said to my clients, it's like, even if I used the exact same materials that you did, but in a different order and in a different way, and maybe added a couple layers in, I will have a profoundly different outcome than you do. And so I teach them my approach, which is different. But my outcomes, they're not comparable to what's out there. And I had a project recently for a commercial firm that I'd been chasing a couple times to just tell them, I'm like, look, my path is so much easier if you just let me do this on the front end of your project. Come in here and make your process for your vendors. And it's hard for them to do it because you're kind of disrupting the business model. And so that's been, I guess, one of the challenges. But I got a call from them. They were 8 months into a project. 8 months. There was four different vendors involved trying to get this one color. And none of them could do it. Not one. I mean, the samples were just, I was shocked how bad they were. But in that world, people accept. They just like, they're like, throw up their hands after a while and say, okay, this is the best we can do. You know, my favorite line is, this is our best possible outcome, or, you know, we're pretty close in the ballpark. Those are just terrible. You should never have to say that to a client. Anyway, so they're like, we need your help here. And I said, I'm heading out to the East Coast for 12 days. I was kind of irritated with them. I said, you know, what part of this conversation did you not get? You're 8 months into this project. How many thousands of dollars have you burned through? And what have you gotten for that huge investment? Nothing. So anyway, the moral story is I said I would make the color when I got back. I got back on a Sunday. I said, I'll have the color for you on Wednesday morning. I delivered that color on Wednesday morning. It was approved because it was perfect. Not close, not in the ballpark. Perfect. And how long did it take me? One day.
Plus years of experience.
Yeah, plus years of experience. I'm not going to say that that's not important, but it's because I take a different approach and I use the same materials that they did, but I got the color.
So what is it that you did different? You said you used the same materials.
Every one of them used stain on the wood first. And you cannot do that. The whole mentality is a production mentality. And so when you take stain and you put it on the wood, because the pigments that are used in stain today are not, they're just not good quality. You could take stain and put it on and let it sit till it dries and wipe it off. And it's only going to get so dark. And so then they put another one on. Or they put a toner on. But they might make a toner out of stain or have pigments in it. It hides the wood. And so when you're trying to get a color, sometimes the best approach is to build it in layers. When you take the wood and you put a wash coat down first. These are just technical aspects of how to get a color. You put a wash coat down, and you can make a wash coat in a myriad of ways, but in this particular way, I just make one because it's cheaper to make one than to buy one off the shelf. Most coatings are mostly solvent, and once you understand that a gallon of stain is probably 75 or 80% solvent. Pigment and binder are the small components. You can make it cheaper and have far better control than what comes out of that can. And so I made a wash coat.
And as you're stepping along this, what is a wash coat?
So a wash coat is a very thin layer that stops the stain from fully penetrating. So it gives you the color, but it takes the blotchiness out. So when you put the wash coat down, in this instance, it was 90% acetone, which is a hot solvent. And a hot solvent hits the wood and it's dry. It gases off. But it's the carrier for the binder. The binder, in this instance, was a catalyzed coating that they were going to be doing in a closed facility. So the wash coat is 90% acetone and 10% catalyzed coating. That's your binder. And you spray that on, and the only thing that sits on there is the 10% of binder. But it's not a complete film. It's just a thin, thin layer. Then you put the stain on, and the stain colors the wood, but it's not muddy because it can't fully penetrate. The pigment can't fully penetrate into the pores. But it's not dark enough now. So now you have to do a toner. And a toner is another high-level skill, whereas actually you're taking the same kind of process as a wash coat. It's still, again, mostly solvent. But this time there's pigment or some kind of coloring agent added to the binder mix. And you're putting on thin layers of color. But again, it's mostly solvent. So the minute it hits, it's dry. But it shifts the color. You're adding depth. So you have this clarity. And you get the multiple colors that a sample provides by building it in layers. It's actually faster than stain. Because stain takes time to dry. And so in this instance, this was a production type mentality with my approach. And so literally, I made that color in a day. And then the look they wanted was almost a dead flat. And in a commercial environment, the best product that was available at the paint store was a 5-degree sheen. 5-degree sheen means when you look at a coating, sheen levels are dead flat, which is technically zero, or full gloss, which is 100. 0 to 100 degrees. 5-degree sheen is plus or minus 5%. So even though they say 5 degrees, when you look at it from an angle, it still looks like there's a sheen there.
Just ever so slightly.
Just ever so slightly. But it was enough that it was going to throw off this look. But because I research so much, I know of a coating that's from Europe that had less than 4%. And when you manipulate it in a way, it was almost like 2%. Well, I mean, you can't really even perceive it 4%, the 4-degree. So I specified this coating that wasn't available. You know, I knew where to get it. I had it shipped in. I put it on that door. And they were perfect. And it's just that level that I play at, where you can design every layer to get X. It's possible, because I do it every day.
Definitely a high level of skill and approach. How is this applicable to, say, flooring and the longevity and the need to withstand, you know, foot traffic? How would you use this, say, in a flooring capacity?
This episode's trivia question is, how much energy equals 1 horsepower? This was part one with Robert Chickie. Next episode will be the second half. Here is a short snippet from part two.
Today's high school kids, who are our next generation, are told that college is your only path, and that's just crap. Because most kids that go to college pick careers that are not going to give them the kind of return on their investment that you're going to make in a trade. It's not even close. I mean, you realize what a skilled tradesman can earn in his or her lifetime. You know, you're coming out of college with debt, usually a pretty significant debt that might take you 15, 20 years to pay off. You're not actually making good money until you're deep into your career. 10 or 15 years in a skilled craftsman who has that mentality can make some significant money.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Blue Collar Voices Show. On this episode's page on bluecollarvoices.com, you will find show notes and any relevant links. If you are not subscribed to get notifications of new show episodes, you can do that at bluecollarvoices.com as well. Hey, let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.
I'll be back.